Welcome to Recovery Devon Podcasts. We're a community interest company working to support mental health recovery in Devon. Our podcasts invite people with ideas of all kinds which explore mental health and what it means to be fully human.
Welcome to the Recovery Devon Podcast with Marie Ash and Courtney Summer, who have taken some time out this morning to have a chat with me about self-harm. And to put a bit of a boundary and a container around that, we are talking about self-harm in adults and living long-term with self-harm. So if you haven't heard my voice before, my name's Em Flint. I'm a community development worker with Recovery Devon. Marie, let's hear from you.
My name's Marie Ash. I'm the senior peer support worker here in North Devon for Devon Partnership Trust. I'm also involved as chairman of Ask for Jake, which is a suicide prevention mental health awareness group here in Braunton, North Devon, which was set up following the death of Jake McPhail. I'm involved in many, many different things in mental health, and I'm also involved in suicide prevention. But I think I'm blessed to be a wife, a mum and a nan, and a wild swimmer, which for me is my sort of saviour. It's the place you can go and forget the world for a little bit. And just enjoy being at one with nature. So I've experienced self-harm in my life, which actually started when I was an inpatient here in North Devon a long time ago now. But you live with that in some respects for the rest of your life. So this is something I do feel passionately about, and supporting people around self-harm.
And you wear so many hats. I don't know if you mentioned that you're also a director of Recovery Devon.
No, actually, I didn't. I forgot to mention that, which is, it's another bit that's fundamental, looking at recovery and what that means for someone, offering help or that enabling, walking alongside someone else in their journey and offering hope that things can change. There's many hats.
Many hats, busy person. And so from one busy person to another, Courtney, would you like to say hello and let us know where you're from?
I feel so excited by Marie's hats that I feel reluctant to go on to mine, but I will. Yeah, I wear lots of different hats. So I'm Courtney Summer. I use she, her pronouns. One thing I do is I'm doing a PhD at the University of Exeter. I'm in my second year. I do research around medicine, sociology of medicine, the history of medicine, the role of medicine in people's lives. I also have experience in the suicide prevention intervention world. I've been working in that for the past few years, kind of going on trainings, supporting people with experience of suicidal thoughts or attempts. And then, yeah, more recently, I've moved on into the kind of self-harm world, so to speak, which is, again, like the kind of suicide prevention stuff, inspired by my own experiences of self-harm, thoughts of suicide and suicide attempts. Yeah, and that all kind of began when I was quite young, in my kind of early teens. I'm now in my mid-20s, so a decade into the journey, shall I say. Yeah, and I'm also, more recently, about a year ago, co-founded an organisation called Make Space with two magnificent people, Veronica Heaney and Bathsheba Wells-Dion. Yeah, a huge shout out to them. So we create spaces to have different kinds of conversations about self-harm, ones that maybe don't start with thinking about stopping self-harm, that maybe think about living with self-harm, appreciating self-harm for what it's worth, what role it plays in people's lives. Yeah, and we're quite early on in that journey of doing that work. Yeah, some really exciting things coming our way.
Thank you, Courtney. So thank you to both of you for bringing your whole selves into this Zoom room. People who are listening to this will already have read it in the blurb that comes with the podcast, but probably just good to name that self-harm and suicidal ideation will be two subjects that we will be touching on during this podcast, and we'll make every effort to make it a safe listen for people who it's a sensitive area for. But just be aware as you listen, take good care of yourself as we go, and we'll do our best to take care of you too. So to make a bit of a container again, to kind of establish the boundaries around what we're discussing today, I'm just going to read out the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. That's what NICE stands for, the NICE guidelines on longer term management of self-harm. This is the definition that they open with. So I'm just going to read it out, and then maybe we can see what we think about it. The term self-harm is used to refer to any act of self-poisoning or self-injury carried out by an individual, irrespective of motivation. This commonly involves self-poisoning with medication or self-injury by cutting. There are a number of important exclusions that this term is not intended to cover. These include harm to the self arising from excessive consumption of alcohol or recreational drugs, mismanagement of physical health conditions, body piercing or starvation arising from anorexia nervosa. In the past, various other terms have been used, including parasuicide and attempted suicide. And they also say that self-harm is associated with a range of mental disorders rather than a specific diagnosis. So there's a lot in there, but I kind of wanted to name early that we're getting quite specific about what we mean about self-harm here. And there's definitely space to have a conversation about things that might constitute self-harm in a different way, such as addiction, mismanagement of medical conditions. But that's not where we are today with this conversation. So any responses to that definition from NICE?
That's a really broad definition, and it's how to actually look at what would that be like for the individual, for the person themselves. And that is often going to be different in different circumstances. I don't know what you think, Courtney. I think it's hard to define.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's a very slippery thing to try and pin down, particularly when you look at the ways that self-harm comes up or plays out in people's lives. I'll speak from my own experience. You can cross in and out of the boundary of falling in that definition, but still with things that feel like they come from the same place or do the same thing. And I think that would be my kind of broader contention with definitions that make that kind of division, that I think in some ways it's really helpful to make divisions around what we're going to consider to be and not to be self-harm. But I think that also sometimes does a bit of alienating work. And that actually, if we get too specific about what we mean by self-harm, people don't see themselves in it, and that can be really difficult for people supporting people with experience of self-harm, that they may read definitions like that and think, oh yeah, self-harm's something that I've never done, and this person who has experience of self-harm is doing something which is, you know, really doesn't resonate with my experience. And I think actually when we think carefully about it, we all have ways to support ourselves that maybe cause us more harm than good. Yeah, I think when we start to have a conversation about self-harm that acknowledges that we all do things to cope, some of those that we're happy with and some of those we're not, then we have very different conversations about what it means to support someone and what that support needs to include.
When you were saying about that, Courtney, I was just sort of thinking about my experience, and I think to a degree, unknowingly, I was doing that at an early age to actually get out of a situation that was really quite distressing for me. And so sometimes it can be, for me, I self-harmed in different ways to actually manage the turmoil that was going on inside of me. I couldn't find the words to verbalise what was happening, actually, but that was a way of trying to express something. And I think that's the difficulty, because it is different for different people, and over time even that can change. So it's not something that is static, that you can put a name to, or, you know, dare we say a label. That is very changeable.
That point around it taking quite a complex role in our lives is one that I think can, you know, make space in the work we try to do, try to kind of unpack or create more room for, that actually people can kind of have varying relationships with their self-harm. It can be, they can kind of befriend it in some ways, that it can actually be really helpful or, you know, supportive in a very difficult situation. Some people dislike it, and all the varying shades in between. I think that sometimes definitions can narrow it to the point where we lose a lot of that complexity. I had a reaction, or felt a reaction inside myself around the self-harm. It can be to do with a range of disorders. obviously the NICE guideline works within a medical framework, so I understand why that language is used, but I think there are really important conversations starting to happen around, is the language of disorder one that's helpful for us? What does it do? It gives us, you know, access to services and stories and ways of understanding our experience, but it also requires us to do some things like not acknowledge the genius actually in some people's ways of coping to really impossible situations.
When you voiced that, Courtney, I could see just the relief on the faces of everybody in this room and a lot of nodding with what you've just said. So I feel listeners might be nodding along with you. So I wanted to let them know that they're not alone in that.
I think, you know, when exactly as you were saying, Courtney, about, you know, we're given diagnoses and labels. So part of my diagnosis is emotionally unstable personality disorder. And along with that comes so much misunderstanding, the stigma, the labelling, all of those sorts of things. But actually, you can then internalise yourself. So, you know, you're given this label and told what's not possible, what you can't do, what you will do. Actually, you lose. And this is from my experience. I lost who Marie was because I became what I was told I would be. And actually, that's not helpful because you lose sight of who you are. And it's so important. And then you take on those things, those what people say that you will do, and especially around self-harm. And there is an element at times about not being able to verbalise that darkness or that trauma or the not just not having the words to express what you want to express. I mean, and again, this is from my experience. I can't talk for, you know, for anybody else. And it's really difficult then when it's loaded down with expectations and that, you know, the raised eyes, it's one of them. All of the stuff that goes along with that particular diagnosis can be really challenging. And I think that's something that for me personally feels like I want people to be able to understand and to support somebody in their journey with their self-harm in a way that's meaningful, that's compassionate, that's caring within peer support in a way that is working together on this.
Yeah, thanks, Marie. And to kind of expand on that as well, that, you know, we need ways of supporting people that are meaningful and compassionate, but also that have the, I think I'd use the word courage. I think it takes a lot of courage to support people in the ways that are meaningful for them and to acknowledge that doing so may not be about stopping self-harm. It may not be about finding different ways to self-harm. It may have absolutely nothing to do with someone's self-harm, even though that may be the thing that as someone supporting someone else, we feel most worried about their self-harm, but someone else may feel indifferent or happy or any range of things. And I think that's something from my own experience of self-harm that I think has really been missing and that I've only really got from other people with experience of self-harm is kind of being met with a sense that it's up for grabs what self-harm means for in my life, and that's somewhere that we need to start with a conversation. And that's something I'd really, you know, love to see more of in the world, that we were able to be courageous enough to accept that maybe someone can live with self-harm and can do so very well.
As we're talking, I'm thinking about that moment of disclosure and inviting somebody else into, or being instructed really to tell, to disclose if you're at a crisis point. So I'm going to share something from both sides of that conversation really. So I've been in mental health crises and I've had the question, are you self-harming? I mean, it's right there on the, I forget what it stands for, the GAD, is it the Generalized Anxiety Disorder Questionnaire in the PHQ-9? One of the questions is, have you thought about hurting yourself? And it's a difficult question to be asked because for me, self-harm has never showed up in any of the conventional ways that are described here in the NICE guidelines. But as I've learned more over the years, I can recognise that, yes, absolutely, I was self-harming in some within the boundaries that we're talking about today. And then there's that fear of, so if I say that I'm self-harming, is there like a whole other level of something that's going to happen? Is it, I've crossed the Rubicon and said that I'm a self-harmer? Do I fall into a silo that I'm never going to get out of? So there's that side. And then having also been a community mental health worker and worked in recovery houses, I've been in the position of asking people that question, as I guess you two have as well. And that comes with some fear and trepidation from that side too, because if somebody discloses self-harm, then I have the duty of care in whatever role I'm currently in. And there's honestly some fear about, if I don't manage this correctly, am I going to expose somebody to infection or a hospital admission, or, you know, and to be really, really honest, what's the implication for me if I mismanage this? So that moment of disclosure is a pretty loaded one on both sides. The reason I bring it up is just looking at some of the stats around self-harm. I mean, I can read out what's in the report here. It's something like between 400 and 500 per 100,000 women in the average year in the UK, and between 300 and 400 per 100,000 for men in the UK. So it's high, but I'm conscious as I'm reading that figure that that's only the people who have actually disclosed and had a conversation at some point that have arrived in the stats books. And there's a great deal of people who probably don't even know that what they're doing is self-harm and don't identify in that way.
And I think that really links in well with being able to have those open and honest conversations where somebody feels safe and supported to be able to. So when you ask, are you thinking of self-harming or do you self-harm, that it's held in very much a non-judgmental support, understanding, and, you know, yeah, I use the word compassionate way again, as opposed to, I suppose from my experience, especially going into A&E, in being very much judged and, you know, resented almost. I know for me there was many times when I went to A&E for help and actually felt worse and went home and re-self-harm because I was already made to feel like the lowest of the lows. What I did, I already felt that way. I went for help and was, that was just confirmed and actually put on top of that. It's, I think this is where it becomes really complex. But I think if we can sit with those feelings, with that person, with those feelings, and understand what is the meaning behind that, what is this doing for you, supporting you in that. I think it was Courtney that said about being courageous, and it is about being courageous, about saying, okay, so what's happening for you? What happened in the moments before? What happened in that moment? What's happening now? And I'm really, really understanding it. And this is my personal view, not services, but actually I think that's something that a lot of services across the board struggle with.
I think the conversation that we've been having so far about, you know, the care that we want to receive is, at least for me, where I think the power is in the kind of peer support, service user, survivor movement, which I think is doing really, really exciting things at the moment. I think there is a bit more space in non-institutionalized relationships to do that courageous work, to hold each other. And I really, you know, I think there's a lot of difficult red tape, I think, as Em was saying, around what a disclosure does, what kind of procedures and processes that it kicks off. And I think that there's a really important and difficult piece of work to be done around safeguarding, like radical safeguarding policies that create space for people to kind of have autonomy, or the space for us to not know what might happen and feel as though, yeah, we can hold some more of this complexity. And, you know, it's not my work to do, but I think that it's really exciting. Yeah, and then there's a difficulty as well, which is that I think, you know, services, because of those reasons, because of their functioning as like a, you know, a big institution with all of its policies and procedures, very well me kind of talking about peer support stuff or non-formalized care, but at some point some people may actually need emergency medical care or not even emergency medical care, just like care for the consequences of self-harm, and that then forces people to interact with services that maybe sometimes do understand them and maybe in other ways don't, and then, as you say, Marie, end up doing more harm than good. Another point on the kind of statistics on self-harm, I think there's a whole nother conversation to be had around like who self-harm gets seen in a gendered sense, in a racialized sense, in what kind of behaviors do we consider to be self-harm? Even the conversation around what kind of age are people who self-harm? I think there's a whole group of people, older people, and older being like people over 20, right? That have experience of self-harm, let alone people who are older than that still in 40s, 50s, 60s that we find coming to us actually that feel totally erased in conversations on self-harm and kind of ashamed, like self-harm has been made a young person's thing. And that's where a lot of the concern is, a side but not an important point around binary gendered way of presenting the statistics on self-harm, and that actually a lot of people who fall in the middle or outside or want nothing to do with that way of defining themselves may not be disclosing their self-harm simply because there isn't a box on the form that they see themselves in. So.
I think you put that so well, and especially the age gap, because you do, you know, it's seen as almost something that young people do, but I know people that are 70s, 80s and, you know, and are self-harming in a way that they themselves can acknowledge but wouldn't to maybe anybody else. Gender identity and all of that comes into it. And I don't know, does that relate back to those very open and honest conversations and just that awareness? And actually sitting, I think as well, sitting with that risk at times, you know, I think especially for services, that is something that is really difficult because you are supposed to protect, or that seem to protect, to stop that happening. But actually, sometimes in that you disempower the person to manage what's happening for them. So how can we then look at, well, what other ways are there, or how can we support you to actually develop that in a way that you want to? Because it has to be a two-way, it's got to be two-way. You cannot impose this on someone, because all that will do is shut it down and almost put it underground. So how do we have that kind of open conversation about, is what can we do with this? Again, going back to that, what's the meaning behind it for you? What was happening for you at that moment in time? Would you like to look at doing something different? And it's not something that happens overnight. It is about a long, much longer term plan.
Yeah, thank you. So with my service delivery head on, because that's kind of where I tend to go when I'm thinking about change, a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. So one is looking again at these NICE guidelines. There are some training recommendations, and something I found really interesting was that training professionals in suicide prevention seem to be really key in giving people working with people who are self-harming a bit more confidence in separating out suicidality from self-harm. Because I think even in that definition that NICE had right at the beginning of this paper, the two seem to sit very closely together in the minds of professionals. And I'd like to hear from both of you on whether you think that's accurate. But my personal feeling, from my personal experience, is that they were actually very different. They were both symptoms of distress at times. You know, suicidality and self-harm were symptoms of distress. But self-harm for me was also very much a coping mechanism that actually helped to distance me from suicidality. So a professional that I work with, I was telling them that this podcast is coming up, and they gave me permission to share anonymously a story of theirs from a time that they were on an eating disorders unit, and they began to very responsibly self-harm to deal with the food, the dietary program that they'd been put onto. They felt that they were out of control with their eating. So their way of establishing control was to self-harm. So yeah, they're self-harming in a very open and responsible way. And they were discharged from the unit because they were self-harming. So all support was closed to them. So I just can't imagine the shame and the desperation that would come in that moment. And as I'm saying this, I want to make clear, this is an example from a long time ago. So any listeners, I hope that other people wouldn't have that experience.
That just, it really touched me. It made me feel goosey that, oh my goodness, that poor person. What was their hope, you know, the hoped for outcome? It's almost like, in a way, you're being punished on top of the distress that you're already in. You're being punished for trying to live with the distress you're living with, because that's what it's often about. It's trying to manage something that, or having some control when all aspects of your life might feel out of control. You can't condemn someone because they're trying to live their life in a way that is possible. You know, within suicide prevention work, there is the increased risk then from self-harming to suicide. But again, it's how can we prevent people from getting to that point when that seems like the only option? So right at the beginning, start to explore what's happened to you and what matters to you, and then work from there together on, okay, so how would you like this to go?
I think that's a really devastating and painfully common experience in kind of like no self-harm policies, which I think are really, I don't know, cruel. I think that people are more creative and genius than they're given credit for, and that actually sometimes people are so kind of willing and determined to keep going in the way that makes sense to them, that even involves being willing to hurt oneself. And I think that when you frame it that way, actually, yeah, as I said before, you have a lot more kind of admiration for people. And I think there's an even less high stakes, I don't know if that's quite the right word, there's an even more common example of that, which is in my experience of accessing services. I went to a kind of low risk service, and I was asking for some support, and they asked, did I have thoughts of suicide and had I been self-harming? And the answer was yes to both of those. But I also explained that they weren't things that I was worried about. They were things I've been living with for a long time. But, you know, I wanted to be honest that something around self-harm and thoughts of suicide, which I think do share a kind of common thread, or at least in my experiences, feelings of being isolated and feeling shameful. So if someone asks me, it's kind of part of my agenda and my recovery to actually say yes, right? To kind of not feel the shame and say yes. And for that reason, then they said, okay, well, we have to discharge you from the service before we can even offer you support. Because of our tolerance to risk, they didn't frame it that way, but I think that's really what it's about. Because of our tolerance to risk, you can't come here. So we're going to send you to the high risk service. And because I was quite happy with my self-harm, because I was having thoughts of suicide, but not kind of making attempts at my life, they said, well, you're quite low risk, actually. And then you end up in this kind of like middle ground where you're kind of waiting for the high risk place to have you. I was speaking to someone else the other day who runs Hearts and Minds, a peer support service for young people, how young people often end up in that situation, and then actually escalating self-harm becomes the only way to access support. And I think that that's, again, a really difficult and cruel way of doing things. Yeah, and I think there's one more point that I wrote down as well around, like, if we're talking generally about, like, what does a disclosure do? I think there's often a confusion about why people disclose, like, why do we want to tell people about self-harm? And I think, or why would you want to encourage people to tell you about self-harm? And I think And again, I think that's a commonality with suicide intervention stuff, is that people often think it's because people want to stop or find those feelings really difficult or, you know, need alternative strategies. But I think for me, it's always been about shame and isolation, and that actually there's something really powerful about being able to tell someone that you're feeling really intense stuff and someone being quite calm in their response and feeling like you've shared it with someone who feels like it's totally manageable and totally possible. And I think I've always found that really disarming.
Thank you. It's reminded me a bit of suicide prevention work, which I know is another area that we've all worked in. Me less so, because I've personal experience of being bereaved by suicide, so I do find it hard to work productively in that area. But something around that courageous conversation about suicide, like actually mentioning the word someone in distress, have you considered suicide, just saying the word and having it out there and responding to their answer without alarm, without freaking out, without blue lighting somebody in to deal, can just be a huge relief of pressure.
I think, yeah, that's something that we're working on with us, especially at the moment, is training people to know how to ask the question, are you feeling suicidal? And to be really specific about what you're asking, to be able to sit with that and then look at, okay, so what can we do? And again, even with that, there's almost like a continuum of, so if somebody is disclosed, but they don't have a plan, what can you do then? And how that can change. And I think it's those conversations and being able to have those, no matter what, with some courage, you can have those. Maybe everybody wouldn't want to do that. We'll all deal with it differently. But I think sometimes explaining to people why you do these things can help, because otherwise you don't know.
Yeah, thank you, Marie. What I guess I'm trying to steer towards is talking about what we would like to see. What can we learn from other approaches, such as the fantastic work of people like Action to Prevent Suicide and Pete's Dragons around having great conversations around suicide? Is there anything we can borrow from that in talking about self-harm? Or how about this for a question? What would each of us have liked to have had in terms of a courageous conversation around self-harm?
I think for me, was there a meaning behind it? What can we do moving forward? And sometimes it can be very basic. If somebody's on the ward, they might end up with someone sitting outside of the room. So how can you sometimes have that conversation? Or is that even the right time to do it? Okay, so let's understand what's happening for you.
I think that there are things that we can borrow from the suicide intervention prevention world. I think the kind of key point of departure, though, you know, to say in the first instance, is that the work directed at supporting people with thoughts of suicide, the goal really is to prevent. Whereas I think that can't be our aim when supporting someone with experience of self-harm. But I do think something that world has really opening up, the possibility of having kind of courageous conversations, one where you can call self-harm self-harm and call suicide suicide. And I think people are starting to think, oh, wow, it's really possible to have different kinds of conversations. And the second thing that I think the suicide intervention prevention world is doing is opening up this thing around tolerance to risk, even though I am a bit kind of reluctant to use just the word risk, maybe difficulty to tolerance someone else's pain. I think the kind of support that I would want would be twofold, really. And the first one would be for people to do their own reflection and work before ever having an interaction with me, that actually we all need to find ways of sitting with, what does it mean for us that someone else is in pain? And that's really hard to deal with. It's really, really hard to think that other people are in pain and there's often not much we can do about it. And how do we be well with other people rather than trying to kind of escape that through getting or asking or forcing, depending on where we are. And then in terms of the conversation that we're actually having, yeah, being able to ask, use frank terminology and words, because I often won't when I'm asking for support. I'll do it in very evasive, confusing ways in which I'm often trying to confirm that what I'm doing is bad and I should be ashamed of it. Yeah, and in those frank conversations, that sense that I think Maria has spoken about a lot of compassionate, patient, considerate support that's able to really hold the complexity of what self-harm is doing in someone's lives and what they want from that conversation and from that support.
I was thinking as well about being out with the person, about what kind of language they'd like to use. You know, I'm thinking about, you hear about risk management and managing your symptoms. That, and somebody was saying to me the other day that they really hate that word. So, okay, you know, what language is right for you? You know, what is it that you want to express? And how can we talk about that in a way that feels right for you? And I think as well about explaining, so say you're in an inpatient ward and you're self-harmed and things are put into place, but actually being able to explain why they are and what that hopes to achieve, so that then maybe there is a chance for that opening then of that conversation about, okay, this is what you expect it to do, but this is what it will do for me. And then is there a way to cross those over? Is there a compromise that we can come to? A sharing of understanding of, and a sharing of learning? Because it's only when we can understand something that we can make a change, if you want. I mean, I know for me, it was only when I understood what I was doing and whether or not I wanted to continue or not, that things could change. I think that's a really important thing to have, is that understanding.
Something's just occurred to me and I'm really excited. I've just written it down in big letters. I keep hearing people say, and I've experienced it for myself, that sometimes self-harm is an attempt to communicate something that you can't find words for, either for yourself or to communicate to someone else. I'm wondering if there's some, if it really speaks to the importance of creative therapies like arts therapies and drama therapies in finding ways to say the unsayable. Because I'm studying somatics, I'm really interested in the fact that self-harm seems to be a body expressing, using a body, something that they can't find words for. Mm. So what can we explore that will allow people to better express these unspeakable things through movement, drawing, art, drama, music, whatever it might be? I think that's a possible, very hopeful route.
I would absolutely agree. I know for myself, it literally would be a way of, that's how much I'm hurting. But I think at that time, I don't even think I knew why I was hurting. I was hurting and I knew there was something there, but I didn't know what it was. And yeah, I think there's so many different ways now that we could have to express that. But we did have a discussion when we were doing the Chill Swim research project into, you know, because going into really cold water is painful. Is that a type of self-harm? Is that because you almost get the euphoria when you come out? So you go into something that is painful, but you come out feeling much better. Would you class that as self-harm?
It's definitely what I would call sensory seeking. I've known quite a lot about autism. That's what we would call a sensory seeking behaviour. And not all, but many autistic people do seek out things like loud music and head banging and rocking and flapping, because it helps to discharge a lot of nervous energy. And things like hot baths and cold swims are in that sensory seeking.
I think my answer to your question, Emma, that other ways that don't require talking is like an unequivocal, excited yes. And I think that, like, you know, not only is it specific to self-harm, but also in kind of the rationalization of what's happened in kind of psychiatry or mental health services, that the support that's offered is largely around talking, understanding, quite a kind of like cognitive, you can think your way out of it. You know, there are lots of people that doesn't work for, like people who are deaf accessing services that are appropriate for them to understand, people who just don't like talking much, people who don't talk, people who are neurodivergent, people who are from who are not kind of white British or white European and have different ways of experiencing things which are more through the body. So yeah, I think there's that element, and there's also the fact that like there are things that are really hard to say, and maybe they don't need to be said either through words, that there are other ways of coping with difficulty or experiencing our own difficulty where we can just kind of like let it come and let it go without kind of grabbing it and wrestling with it, that some things we just don't understand and they just need some space, be it physical space if you're moving, or space on the page, or, you know, space in the air if you're singing it or shouting it or whatever, or space in the river if you're swimming it, that we can kind of like put things. I wonder if self-harm like could be in some ways a response to this like need to be using words, and that something only becomes inexpressible if you're asked all the time how to express it. But that if it's okay that we don't understand what's going on, and that it's all quite kind of confusing and wobbly, yeah, that tolerance to difficulty may increase.
It's not meant as a negative reflection, but is that something that often services then find really challenging for themselves? Because to say that you have to sit with that unknown is really difficult. And I should think that would be extremely challenging for a lot of services across, and I would even go to say across the world. And how do you classify it? Because what here might be classed as self-harm, somewhere else could be classed as really positive. It then becomes a worldwide conversation. I think, well, that might be a bit too broad for this morning.
Oh, I think bringing in cultural difference is absolutely spot on, Marie.
But I think that difficulty, right, of like we're having a, or at least I'm finding it, exciting conversation about holding difficulty, not expressing stuff, and then how you kind of translate that into services or like or formal structures, that is something that we need to reckon with. Like there is a whole restructuring and reordering that needs to be done, and I think that there are some exciting steps being made in that, both ground up in terms of kind of what the service user or survivor user movement is doing, and also in like a willingness, though often with its limits, within services and institutions to start reckoning with these questions within the constraints that they have to operate within. But yeah, I'm excited that it feels like something's turning, and even though I can see its limits.
I think I would absolutely agree with you. And I think the exciting thing is that services are looking at how can we do this differently? What is possible? And whether or not that will increase as well with the community mental health framework coming in, so it becomes much broader. But I know that there are definitely people looking at, well, okay, so how can we look at this differently? How can we support people? Whether it's, you know, on an inpatient, whether it's community, whether, you know, especially in A&E. I did have the privilege of working on a leaflet for A&E explaining about self-harm going into A&E, and worked with an amazing young lady, still in contact with her because I think she's just amazing. But for her, working on a leaflet that was then given to people in A&E actually was a massive turning point for her, because she felt that she was then using her experiences, her thoughts, what was happening, and turning it into something that was really positive, because she turned that around, and that was absolutely incredible. So together we use people's experiences with their, and co-producing and looking at, okay, so how can we do things differently? How can we do that in a way that doesn't put you into a box of, well, I don't know, like you're a self-harmer or you're this or whatever, that actually you're a person, you're a human being, and you've got so many talents and gifts and things that make you a special person. Let's find what they are.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. Is there anything else at DPT that you want to speak to with peer support work or anything?
So I think with peer support work, it will be really looking at how can peer support workers have some of those conversations with people that they're in contact with, on an inpatient ward. And we are looking sort of in conjunction with the Safer From Suicide team as well about how do we do that on a ward. So is it the term that they use, the positive risk management, because sometimes there's someone that's with you 24/7. Is that actually normal? You know, when you go home, you're not going to have that. So is that actually going to increase your risk or decrease? It might in that moment, at that time, but actually long term, what is that doing for you? So looking at the short-term risk, but balancing it against the long-term, how do we do that? So this is sort of just beginning to happen, but it's something that I think can really and will be really beneficial. And risk is something that's very difficult to sit with. So I think there are things happening that I'm going to be involved in, actually looking at, well, how do you do that going forward? And how do you make it more empowering, I think is the word, for that person to think about, okay, well, this is what I can do. As opposed to, well, that's it, everything's taken away and you've just got this, which is totally disempowering. So let's re-empower people. Let's allow them to have control and regain that control over their life. And yeah, so they have to take, you know, we all have to take an element of responsibility. If we know, if we understand what that responsibility is, then that's when we can build on it.
Courtney, the floor is yours for anything you want to drop in and also speak about Make Space. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you're offering and what's coming up.
The area that I think I'm most excited about or is bringing me the most amount of hope at the moment is, as I've said a few times, survivor user or service user or peer-led kind of movement that I think I would situate, or I would definitely situate Make Space's work within. And I would just give a huge shout out to the National Survivor User Network, who are an incredible umbrella organisation that are supporting a lot of really cool work by groups of people who, you know, have experience of working with particular disorders or having been labelled with a particular disorder or experience of the world, and really leading what kind of support those people need in ways that take account of nuances that are often missed. So, you know, power, privilege, systems of oppression, neurodivergence, racial justice and reckoning with whiteness, for example. So I would situate Make Space within that. And we are running quite a exploratory organisation where we're really trying to just create spaces to continue conversations like the one that we've had here today, and that actually I think having new conversations is quite radical in and of itself, when particularly around self-harm we get boxed in quite quickly. So how do we have different kinds of conversations, generate new ideas, new starting points? And we're really inspired to kind of do that work with lots of different people. So people with experience of self-harm, doctors, psychiatrists, policymakers, NHS management and commissioning. And yeah, I hope the pool of people who join us come more often. And the work that we're currently doing, so from April to the end of May 2021, we're running a programme of events in collaboration with Action to Prevent Suicide, and that's specifically around LGBTQ and queer folk and self-harm, having those conversations with people who support people with experience of self-harm, and also with people in those communities themselves, thinking together what kind of care do we want, what have we had before, and what would we not like again. And it is a creative programme, so yeah, there's art, there's storytelling, there's poetry, there's all sorts.
Yeah, so we'll make sure that the podcast comes with links to everything that's been described here. There's just so many wonderful offers out there. I think that's the message I want to leave listeners with, is that There are lots of conversations like this one happening. We're based in Devon, but you know, nationally, internationally, indeed, I feel like there's a bit of a tipping point. Maybe that's optimistic of me, but I do feel hopeful that this is not an isolated conversation. It's one of many, and there's many more voices out there that I know are looking to express. Please have a look at the resources that will come with this podcast, so that you can find a space to express what you need to and find what you need to. So I'll end by saying thank you very much, Marie, Ash, and Courtney Summer, for being courageous today, sharing some of your own experience and heart and wisdom, and offering hope to others.
And I'd like to say thank you to you both. It's been absolutely fascinating and full of hope. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm leaving today with numerous post-it notes filled with new ideas and pockets of hope, as Marie said. So yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. And hope we cross paths again soon.
Thank you for listening. If you have ideas which explore mental health directly or in imaginative ways, perhaps you'd like to create our next podcast. If you don't know how or don't have any equipment for recording, we'll do what we can to help. Simply contact us. Our email is community@recoverydevon.co.uk. Recovery Devon is a community interest company supported by the Devon Partnership Trust.